Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, 14 years after the events of September 11th, we'll be speaking with filmmaker and journalist Robbie Martin, whose films include American Anthrax and his latest film, A Very Heavy Agenda. We'll be joined by Robbie Martin for the hour. We'll be exploring the events of September the 11th, 14 years later. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today on the program, we look at the events of September the 11th, and we do that with filmmaker and journalist Robbie Martin. Robbie Martin's films include American Anthrax and his newest film, A Very Heavy Agenda. That film explores the warmongering neoconservative Kagan family, particularly Robert Kagan, the Project for New American Century co-founder, author, and husband of U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Eurasian Affairs, Victoria Nuland, whom listeners might recognize her name from ongoing fiasco in Ukraine. And Nuland, of course, is instrumental in creating the tensions that set off the Ukraine crisis. Robbie Martin, in addition to being a filmmaker, is a musician going under the moniker of Fluorescent Gray and is also a contributor to MediaRoots.org. Robbie Martin, you join us in studio.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Robbie, thanks so much for joining us today. And as we look at the 14th anniversary of the events of September the 11th, let's dive into the heart of your newest effort here, A Very Heavy Agenda, that really explores some of the politics and the political characters surrounding the events of 9/11. Could you talk to us a little bit about how you got started on this project and then what you're looking at in the film itself, A Very Heavy Agenda? Robbie?
It started originally as stuff from the cutting room floor when making American Anthrax. So when I was making that project, American Anthrax is a film kind of on the short side. It was maybe 40 minutes long. Basically a story about how the anthrax attacks of 2001 were instrumental in getting us into the Iraq War. They created that stepping stone that allowed the Bush administration to pivot from Al-Qaeda and in Afghanistan to Iraq, the idea of biological weapons. So when I was making that movie, there's a lot of stuff I couldn't include that basically involved neocons going on the media, trying to hype up the fear of anthrax and trying to link it to Iraq. I included some of that in the movie, but there was just so much more of it that I couldn't include. And some of those people who went out and did that included Robert Kagan, William Kristol, who are basically the two head honchos at the Weekly Standard. Robert Kagan is... I didn't really hear of him before. I had heard his name, but I wasn't really familiar with what he did. I was more familiar with, like, the Bill Kristols, the really out-of-control neocons who you see on Fox News all the time that just are unfiltered. They say stuff that is crazy-sounding to most people. You know, Michael Ledeen constantly, openly talks about wanting to invade Iran and do regime change. The difference between people like them and Robert Kagan is that Robert Kagan has, over many years, gotten very good at essentially rebranding neoconservatism. And now he's actually going around calling himself a liberal interventionist, which was sort of the term used to describe more of the Clinton mindset on foreign policy. And he's been very successful at actually rebranding neoconservative ideas to the point now where when Obama got into office, it was one of the books that Obama was reading as he was being inaugurated, you know, along with, like, I think Team of Rivals and some book about Lincoln. But one of, like, the three books was Robert Kagan's book, The World America Made, which is fascinating, too, because not only has he done a really good job at rebranding neoconservatism, he's also gone back into the past. And his father is a famous historian named Don Kagan at Yale, And it's something that I'm sure a lot of historians do, especially with political biases. But what he's done particularly well is he's gone all the way back to the time of the Revolution and sort of is able to portray America as a nation that has always been expansionist and has never been isolationist. And when he talks about it, it's interesting because he almost sounds like someone like Noam Chomsky or Howard Zinn talking about foreign policy, but he's not talking about it in a negative way. He's basically going back into our history, explaining pretty realistically and accurately our militarism. You know, he's not he'll omit certain things, but he puts it through this lens that it's positive.
Well, it's an exceptionalist mythological lens, and it riffs back to the Continentalists and James K. Polk and the expansion into Texas and the Mexican-American War. That was a big to-do, and the Manifest Destiny bragged about the expansionists. And they were called Continentalists, right, because they wanted to overspread the continent. And John O'Sullivan, a journalist, coined that term, Manifest Destiny, because that's an interesting tautological phrase that justifies the mythical greatness that exceptionalism really provides, that kind of umbrella of protection. So that's really fascinating. Of course, I'm an historian, so I have great interest in this and the use of this. And you're saying here that Kagan really is kind of going back through the architecture of this mythology and bringing it up to present in a way such that he's saying not only is this just, right, and proper, but this is the inevitable trajectory of empire. They seldom use that phrase.
Yeah, right? No, he uses it quite openly. And that's what's so interesting about him, is it's almost like he's using our own weapons against us. He's using a lot of the sort of zeitgeist or the world of more lefty politics and anti-militaristic thought, but sort of flipping it upside down to, again, like you said, reinforce this idea of why this is so important and why it's been like this for so long and how we can't stop it because it's vital.
It's using historiography and a certain interpretation of, in this case, neoconservative interpretation, almost like a neo-consensus school interpretation, that what's using history is propaganda.
Exactly.
And in this case, a justification for the 9/11 wars. And as you know, and like we talk about, and Peter, I'm sure, will come in here and have something to say about this. This, the Project for New American Century, right, where Kagan and Crystal were, right, these are the characters that talked about the new Pearl Harbor, right? And that's that rebuilding
Absolutely.
America's defenses. And that infamous passage, of course, Sean Pilger pointing out that he believed that strongly showed that they were using 9/11 as a pretext event, as a cover event, as a trigger event, regardless of what the Bush administration may or may not have to do with the events of 9/11, even though the NSA has recently been found to have said, well, they knew things were happening and did not intervene, right? That's a problematic finding. But putting that aside momentarily, I just wanted to put out that piece here about rebuilding America's defenses, because that's something that I think really should be looked at more carefully. And that passage in the 2000 Rebuilding America's Defenses Project for New American Century document said, the passage suggests a transformation of American armed forces through, quote, new technologies and operational concepts. And then it goes on to say, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor, right, they go on to say that they don't think that they're going to be able to unleash these global plans for the next American century. And then, of course, a year later, the events of 9/11 take place.
Yeah.
Right. So that's an eerie foreshadowing. But it does also indicate that they use those events subsequently then to unleash this Pax Americana, American hegemony, and then now just Kagan's justifying it in the book you're talking about.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that arguably, obviously, they use 9/11 as a pretext, but I would also argue that writing, laying that out, that to do these things, we need a new Pearl Harbor. They wanted a new Pearl Harbor of some kind. And I guess after making this movie, sort of looking back on it, I sort of changed my mind on the whole, my whole view on 9/11, because I feel that you can't prove necessarily that any of these people were involved, but you can pretty strongly prove that they really wanted a new Pearl Harbor regardless of how it was delivered to them.
Well, they certainly had an overall agenda of global dominance, with the U.S. and NATO, of course, being the center of that. Mm-hmm. Controlling and freeing up American capitalism and capitalism, you know, the corporate capitalism worldwide for their use of an agenda of profit-taking anywhere in the world. And anybody that's interfering with that, trying to control the price of oil or interfering with resource-taking over, particularly China and Russia, became the enemy. And those documents at that time were well laid out, saying this is who we have to dominate. We will do that on the ground, and we'll do it from space, wherever it's needed.
Yeah.
We're going to control the world. And, you know, that's sort of reminiscent of the New World Order idea. So these neoconservatives writing back in the 90s, you talk about Don Kagan and his brother Fred, who was at the American Enterprise Institute,
oh, yeah.
which helped fund the Project for New American Century, and those documents that emerged from that. Tell us a little bit more about the Kagan family and who are the tight-knit people inside that group.
Well, Victoria Nuland is probably the most well-known of the family. She's in the family through marriage. She is the Assistant Secretary of State for Eurasian Affairs right now for Obama. She has been in the State Department, I think, all the way back to the first George Bush administration. So she's been in government for quite a long time, but she's been in several different, you know, Republican and Democrat administrations. It's hard to be like she has these politics because she's very good at sort of hiding her own political ideology. But the other side of the family, the actual Kagan part of the family, Robert, his brother Fred, Fred's wife Kim, and the father, Don Kagan, have all done really interesting things that are in all different ways evil to different levels. So, like, for instance, Kim and Fred Kagan, they have their own think tank called the Institute for the Study of War that is widely seen as just this very technical sort of military strategy think tank that's not about politics. But what's interesting about that think tank is that everything they recommend is blatantly something that, you know, a neoconservative warmonger would recommend. Their newest document that I saw was called, I don't know if it was called this, but it was basically about how to defeat ISIS, what we need to do to defeat ISIS. And in the document, they lay out in technical detail all the different facets of what we need to do. We need to send 30,000 new ground troops back into Iraq. We need to send this amount of troops into Syria. And so it just amounts to a policy prescription where if the government was ever at the point where they were ready to do this, they could just look at this civilian think tank document and say, oh, well, somebody already wrote this whole detailed plan up for us. And coincidentally, well, Fred and Kim Kagan also advised the Pentagon heavily on both surges, first the Iraq War surge and then the Afghanistan surge. During the Afghanistan War, there was actually a military internal investigation done on their conduct because General Petraeus allowed them, Kim and Fred Kagan, two civilians, full security clearance and access to everything that even military generals right underneath David Petraeus didn't have. So they were actually in Afghanistan, allowed to go wherever they wanted to, allowed to look at any classified document they wanted to at any level. And we're talking about two actual civilians. These are not military personnel. They weren't elected. They weren't even really appointed as government people. They were advisors, essentially. And if you want to talk about crazy things neoconservatives have said, I mean, Fred and Don Kagan both went on the radio on 9/12/01, one day after 9/11, and they said that Afghanistan was a distraction, that going after the actual perpetrators of the attacks was a distraction, and that we should attack Iraq, and that we also should send ground troops into the Palestinian territories to overthrow the Arafat regime as retaliation for 9/11. I mean, that's insane, but that's what they said.
And again, clearly more evidence of this pretext idea, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But before we do, I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with filmmaker and journalist Robbie Martin, talking about his new film, A Very Heavy Agenda, and we'll continue that discussion after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with journalist and filmmaker Robbie Martin, also a musician, a contributor to MediaRoots.org, also goes under the name Fluorescent Gray for some projects. We're talking about his new film, A Very Heavy Agenda, that takes a look at the neoconservatives, both in the Bush and Obama administration. We left off, we were talking about Victoria Nuland, and even though she, of course, is seen as a diplomat, you were just talking, Robbie Martin, before the break, about some sort of outlandish things that some of these neoconservatives were saying right after 9/11. Certainly, Victoria Nuland's, if you want to continue that trajectory and sort of outlandish things, she was also quoted in a leaked phone call that she F-bombed the European Union.
Yeah.
Right? Basically, her unilateral efforts to do that and said, well, we put $5 billion into the Ukraine and we want to have a say in what's going to go on there. Of course, Joe Biden's son ends up on the board for the major gas company. Strange things happen, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, let's talk about that. And I mean, again, these are more brazen statements. And this is, of course, what your film kind of lays out is the audacity of some of these characters.
Yeah. I mean, Victoria Nuland was pretty much an unknown player. I mean, I don't think most people even knew her name until that leaked phone call came out, which was allegedly done by the Russian government. I don't know if that's true or not, but she did say the EU, and that was something that kind of got most of the attention. But what's more revealing in that phone call is that she's actually talking to the U.S., I guess it would be the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt. She's talking to him on the phone about who from the Ukrainian opposition that they would want to be in the government and who they didn't want to be in the government before the government was overthrown. So this is actually before the, you know, the new government came into Ukraine and before the president was ousted. They were almost doing like musical chairs trying to figure out who to get in there. And they essentially got the people in there, came in there and took over the government that they were talking about on that phone call. And
she was clearly expressing her disdain for waiting for European Union input. And
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and in the same phone call, they're talking about how the Russians are going to try to torpedo whatever they try to do in terms of, you know, helping set up this new Ukrainian government. What was so interesting about Ukraine is, you know, it's in a lot of ways, it's a very messy narrative to comb through. But the Ukraine thing, the reason I think people should look at it as something very suspicious and that there's definitely U.S. involvement is not only because of that phone call, but also the way that the U.S. administration reacted to the new government in Ukraine, embraced it completely with open arms. Immediately when it came into office, it was very different from the way that we treated other new governments and other so-called color revolutions of recent years. We were extremely happy, basically, to have these people in government because we wanted them in government. And it was a long brewing effort to destabilize the Ukraine regime and make it more Western friendly, you know, more pro-Western. So it was, of course, we wanted that to happen.
Well, Robbie Martin, certainly when you talk about destabilization of Ukraine, inside of this very heavy agenda from the neoconservatives, and specifically, of course, Don Kagan, Victoria Nuland, Richard Perle, a number of others that were inside that network, which has taken a leading role in American foreign policy, or actually global foreign policy in many ways, because any government, whether it's Syria, Ukraine, Libya, Iraq, Iran, even Venezuela, if they're not friendly to U.S. NATO interests, meaning interests for capitalism and profit, and are have other agendas in terms of supporting their own people and environmental concerns or whatever, all these other things, they're there to replace them, literally. They're going to reorder the world to eliminate those folks. And talk a little bit more about that in that broader sense, that they're that agenda that's so core and that how these people represented in your movie. Where's that going? I mean, they keep changing names. Now there's the Institute for Study of War, and there's new, you know, Project for New American Century was new then. But, you know, there's other organizations that keep manifesting themselves with this agenda.
Yeah, the newest iteration, Project for New American Century, directly morphed into a new think tank called the Foreign Policy Initiative, which is essentially it's Project for the New American Century Part 2. They closed it down. They knew that the name had become so tainted that they torched it and restarted the whole operation.
all the while having offices in the American Enterprise Institute, the right-wing think tank.
Oh, yeah, the building shared exactly. all those really hardcore neoconservative. I think there was actually another one that I'm forgetting. But, yeah, they were in the same office. Now I think the Foreign Policy Initiative actually shares the same office with the emergency – I think it's the Emergency Action Committee for Israel. I don't know if that's the exact name. But, yeah, so if you go back to the actual Rebuilding America's Defenses document, they lay out – that they want to attack Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Lebanon, Iran, I mean, most of the countries that we've already gone into since 9/11. And I think Wesley Clark, you know, said that he read an internal memo saying that we're going to attack 7 countries in 5 years. It's very similar to that, whatever that internal memo he read said. I mean, it's essentially the blueprint for the Bush administration's foreign policy. But beyond that, which is more disturbing and should be to most people, is that it had such a wide influence on the way that we conduct foreign policy and just the mindset in D.C. that it went beyond the Bush administration, that it influenced the way the Obama administration conducted their foreign policy and influenced most of the way the intellectual class in D.C., how they view the world and foreign policy.
And we're looking at Republicans and Democrats here. We're talking about this neoconservative, Pax Americana kind of ideology.
Yeah.
And we're talking about it in a Republican administration. We're talking about it in a Democratic administration.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, another Democrat at the U.S. State Department spokesperson, Jen Psaki, this spring 2015, she vehemently was denying claims that the U.S. is involved in overthrowing governments, whether it be in Venezuela or elsewhere. In fact, she said, quote, as a matter of longstanding policy, the United States does not support political transitions by non-constitutional means. I mean, again,
so
it's
weird.
I mean, you'd have to be in some kind of strange cave or you know, some kind of bubble forever to not understand the. I mean, that's just double. That's really twisting history and turning it on its head, whether it's the Ukraine example or whether it's Afghanistan, Iraq, all these other countries that we've been involved, Libya, etc. This is a really brazen kind of propaganda that just denies what's obviously taking place on the ground. And that what you're actually saying is, you know, these people had planned these things and they used 9/11 as a pretext to justify all of these types of things.
Yeah. And in the Middle East, you know, the long term goal for the Middle East was, I guess in my mind, it's almost seems like a smaller component of it than I believed it was before, because if you go back to the very origins of the Project for New American Century and the very first article that sort of laid out Robert Kagan and William Kristol's neoconservative agenda, which is called Towards a Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy, you know, that term neo-Reaganite, because they're in love with Reagan, it's all about the Soviet Union. It's all about what they perceive as an unstable world after the collapse of the Soviet Union. They believe the quote-unquote the bipolar world that existed when the Soviet Union and the U.S. were pitted against each other created stability across the whole world, and that it was actually really good for, you know, being able to predict world events and being able to just control things better.
And Francis Fukuyama, historian, conservative historian, wrote The End of History, right, at the collapse of the Soviet Union, and subsequently he admitted that he was incorrect in his assessments, which is kind of interesting because you don't see that very much, you know, the admission of wrongful interpretation or let's just say it's not wrongful, but let's say less accurate kind of interpretation.
He's one of the only people that signed on to PNAC, a Project for New American Century, and some of these other neocon documents that in a lot of ways defected sort of towards the end. He even at one point accused neoconservatism at its heart of being racist by saying that originally, a lot of neocon documents about how to fight wars in the Middle East were based on the premise that Arabs only understand force. And this is actually something that Don Kagan said on 9/12, that he said that they don't respect us when we're not strong. They only respect us when we're strong and that we show them, like, force, which is kind of like a weird, it's kind of almost saying that they're barbarians or something. It's a kind of a racist point of view.
We're speaking with filmmaker and journalist Robbie Martin. We're discussing his newest film, A Very Heavy Agenda. He's also a contributor to MediaRoots.org. Peter?
A Very Heavy Agenda, your film debuted at the 9/11 Film Festival on September 10th in Oakland, California and well received. But you started out earlier talking about, okay, 9/11 happened. We're not sure that we can tie these neoconservative people in specifically. There's a lot of evidence, of course, that there was other involved besides 19 hijackers. But you're saying essentially that this neoconservative global dominance agenda is still core in terms of U.S. foreign policy. And it has a strong intellectual impact on both parties and, I assume, Congress. Mm-hmm. And it continues to be funded and supported in Washington, D.C., with somewhat limited understanding in terms of the American public. So hopefully your movie is expanding on that. So what is that core message from your movie post 9/11, where we're going now in terms of global agendas that the neoconservatives want us to have?
The one that I screened already is part one. It's part one of three parts, and it's called The Catalyzing Event. It's sort of designed to kind of make you soak in the neoconservative rhetoric for as long as you could possibly handle it in order to sort of know your enemy. And I feel like as I was making it, I was trying to make people watch the most powerful, I hate to use that word, the most powerful and destructive types of neoconservative rhetoric that are actually kind of creepily infectious. Like, as you're watching it, and I'm sure you guys, you know so much about history and just the history of war and all our military endeavors, you find yourself agreeing with a lot of the things he's saying, Robert Kagan specifically, mm-hmm. because he does tap into that sort of the reality of our history of militarism and things like that. So I feel like that's the most important takeaway from the movie, is this is really what we're up against. It's not the Michael Ledeens and the Bill Kristols who are just blatantly warmongers. Those people are, in my opinion, a thing of the past. They're kind of passe. They're not really the way that these things are done anymore. It's the Robert Kagans that we really need to worry about. It's the Sam Harrises that we really need to worry about. These people who are able to wrap things eventually or ultimately lead to wars in the Middle East in intellectual, liberalism, essentially. Like, we need to attack the Middle East because they're not liberal enough. That's sort of the Sam Harris perspective, but it also ties into the Robert Kagan perspective, as he goes around saying that he is a liberal. He's not a neoconservative. He doesn't even use that word anymore, which is fascinating, because in reality, that's sort of what he wanted all along, is to erase the black mark of neoconservatism, from recent history, and sort of repackage it as, it's liberalism now. To be liberal, you have to be for human rights, and that means that if they have bad human rights in, Syria, then that means we should overthrow their government. I mean, that's essentially kind of where that logic leads.
We're speaking with independent journalist and filmmaker Robbie Martin, who's a contributor to MediaRoots.org and also a musician under the name of Fluorescent Gray. We're talking about his new film, A Very Heavy Agenda, and we will continue this conversation after a brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking for the hour today with Robbie Martin, journalist, filmmaker, musician. His early film was American Anthrax. Might get into a little bit of that here today because our theme is the 14th anniversary of the events of 9/11. We're specifically speaking about foreign policy, neoconservative ideology behind that. And that is, of course, the focus of Robbie Martin's latest film, A Very Heavy Agenda. So, Robbie Martin, let's continue this conversation. Of course, what it sounds like, too, is that this goes back to, you know, Smedley Butler, War is a Racket. The idea that there's big, this is the military-industrial complex, there's billions of dollars. These people are revolving doors inside and out and with lobbyists and positions in these military companies and so forth. And the interesting thing, too, that we've been hearing is that it's almost like there's this thread, neoconservative foreign policy thread from Republicans to Democrats, whether it's Bush or Obama. And there has been maybe a rebranding, as you talk about, in A Very Heavy Agenda. But where does Hillary Clinton fit into this picture?
It's interesting because after she left the Obama administration, she kind of went around saying that she wanted to go into Syria because of the chemical weapons thing. And that ultimately Obama was the one who decided to reverse course and not do that. It was like when Assad allegedly used chemical weapons on his own people. But right when she got into the Obama administration, kind of going along with that theme, you know, that weird theme that Obama tried to claim that he was, you know, having a team of rivals when he got into office, Hillary Clinton appointed Robert Kagan to a thing called the Foreign Policy Advisory Board, which was very similar to what Richard Perle was doing for the Bush administration for the Pentagon, but Robert Kagan was doing it for the State Department. So, oddly, Robert Kagan and Victoria Nuland were both working for the State Department right at the very beginning of the Obama administration, all the way until Hillary left, which was when Robert Kagan left, and Victoria Nuland is still there. So, yeah, it's interesting because Hillary Clinton, ever since she left office, has been kind of trying to bait the neoconservatives, and it seems to me like she is angling to basically get their support for this upcoming election, which sounds almost unbelievable that a Democrat would be able to get the support of the neoconservatives. But if you think about all the Republican candidates, in a lot of ways, she's still the most neoconservative kind of across the board, maybe besides Marco Rubio. And that's actually the candidate that the Foreign Policy Initiative, a.k.a. PNAC 2.0, has chosen as Marco Rubio. When he did his big speech recently all over the media, it was funny to me because he was standing in front of the Foreign Policy Initiative backdrop, you know, and I knew he was there when I saw it, but none of the headlines were like, oh, he's at the Project for New American Century. It was just kind of like Marco Rubio's announcement, and saw the big logo behind him on the podium.
Yeah, Robbie, the year was, I believe, 2013. There was certainly talk in 2012 about this and the rumblings about the Syrian gas tax. But
yeah, that makes more sense, yeah.
2013, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Peter, you want to jump in here?
Robbie, I want to go back to the word liberal. That was used quite openly 300, 400, 500 years ago to challenge monarchies and to say liberals meant essentially the freedom to do business. That people in the towns, the bourgeois, could in fact engage in mercantilism and trade and make money doing that. And that was called liberal. And including that were human rights, something like habeas corpus and other things. But neoconservatism is really talking from a liberal sense, a freedom to do business, but also a privatization of the world.
Yeah.
And you know, including the military world. So the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, have been organized and supported essentially by private military contractors, mm-hmm. for the most part, in some cases more so than U.S. And soldiers. I mean, they're still the ones on the ground doing the fighting, but in many cases, private military contractors are included in that area as well.
Absolutely.
So this idea of privatization, not only privatization of war, one of the largest corporations in the world now is G4S, which is British with 600,000 employees, which is a security company. And all the big banks are investing in this. So that seems to be an agenda. Now, they're not talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights here, which are quite extensive, and I think I support those. I use every class. I start out with that. But it's business-oriented, and it's privatization. And your philosophy, this movie is talking about what the core beliefs are, where that's coming from. And that seems to be me to be the macro agenda here. Would you agree with that?
Definitely, yeah. And it, at a certain point, it almost becomes like a chicken or egg situation, because when you watch a lot of these neoconservative think tanks do talks about which new wars we should be engaging in, you quickly find out that, you know, each one of these talks is funded by a different defense contractor or sponsored by one. And then on top of that, they take a lot of donations from different defense contractors that they don't have to disclose the amounts they take, because think tanks aren't necessarily under the same rules as other lobbying firms and other kinds of political action committee groups there. But that's the purpose. In a lot of ways, they serve a similar purpose. But instead of like lobbying Congress people, they filter down these policy prescriptions to more of the intellectual D.C. class of people, including not only politicians, but journalists who sort of buy into it. And that's a huge component to it, because you'll see sort of this normalization of neoconservatism that sort of started under Obama, but it sort of ballooned out from there to become something more than just what Obama was doing. It's sort of the way that Syria is talked about now, the way that Ukraine is talked about, you know, the casualness of going into a proxy war with Russia on two different fronts. It's surreal just how normalized it's become in sort of today's dialogue.
Indeed. And again, taking this thread from neoconservatism through Obama, and of course the Obama campaign in 2008 was based on hope and change. Certainly see little of that here, certainly little change. The trajectory has continued. And when it comes to Democrats and Republicans in terms of party leadership, choice on these issues in foreign policy, I mean, the voters don't really have a choice.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, unfortunately, these ideas are just so influential that even if somebody really good got into office, in theory, I still feel like the world and sort of the American intellectual classes have been so hoodwinked and influenced by these philosophies that's kind of almost at this point what we're really up against. It's like politicians are just one component of it. But when you have someone like, you know, I hate to bring him up again, but like Sam Harris going around all these shows that young, more liberal people watch, like Bill Maher and stuff, basically essentially spreading Islamophobia, explaining how you should be anti-Muslim if you're a liberal, things like that. It's very dangerous. And I think that at this point, it's like those ideas that Robert Kagan and Kagan family and people like that have spread around, those are what need to be fought against. Hope and change, you know, it was a nice pipe dream. It's weird for me because I was extremely cynical about Obama from the very beginning. And after making this movie, I feel a little bit sad for him, for what happened. It's almost like he was so naive in certain ways that he...
Or he at least has an Oscar-winning performance.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, just the fact that he reversed course on Syria. I mean, even though we're actually now bombing Syria now, and that sort of went on anyways, I feel like that was one of the only good things he did in his presidency at that point in time. I have no idea how that actually happened, but I'm sure there was enormous pressure from, you know, not just the neocons, but even people like Hillary Clinton, as she said. And I guess what's scary now is Obama has, in so many ways, been an absolutely terrible and disappointing president, but the House voted twice to send offensive weapons to Ukraine, and he hasn't fully authorized it yet, and he's been dragging his feet for over a year on it. And it kind of just got to the point where the neocons realized that the pressure they were putting on his administration wasn't going to do anything in terms of getting that tipping point to occur. But it doesn't really matter, because we're only a little over a year from the next election, and whoever the next president is going to try to overthrow the Assad regime and is going to send offensive weapons to Ukraine regardless. So it's kind of like, you know, too little too late. Even if he was trying to prevent certain things towards the end of his presidency, it doesn't really matter.
So it's interesting, in this iteration, you're characterizing Obama almost as a hurdle to neocons, or sort of he's blocking some of these agendas, even though he had certainly gone along with many other parts of these agendas. But who, in your research and in the making of A Very Heavy Agenda, Who is there to combat neoconservatism? Where are the forces? Did you see forces? Because we're talking about liberal and conservative hawkish groups here. Did you see any real resistance in the establishment? You mentioned in this briefcase where Obama might be accused of foot dragging by neocons, right?
Yeah.
Or sort of a passive resistance. But what do you have to say about that?
Well, just really quickly, I wanted to touch on how if people also go back to the Bush administration, the neocons were very frustrated with him, too, at a certain point. He wasn't going far enough. Actually, very early on, they thought he wasn't going far enough, which is kind of crazy considering how far he went. But same thing with Obama. He was doing everything they wanted. Robert Kagan was praising him. And then at a certain point, there was a turn where they realized he wasn't going to go as far enough for them. So they immediately started to put on the pressure. And that's kind of almost what launched the Foreign Policy Initiative and kicked it into high gear, was that they wanted to put this counterweight and create all this pressure. But as far as who's out there fighting this and is actually addressing the real core issues and the people like Robert Kagan, very few journalists out there are regularly covering this or tracking it. There's a great journalist named Robert Perry who is constantly tracking this. He's actually one of the only people I've seen who is constantly seeing what, you know, the activities of the Kagan family and sort of documenting them throughout the year.
Yeah, Consortium News.
Exactly, yeah. But besides that, I mean, I feel like a lot of the people, like the Noam Chomsky's more of like the older crowd, I don't know if they're really paying close attention anymore to the current iteration of what's going on or these people, you know. But there might be other people out there. I just haven't really seen much.
The Foreign Policy Initiative that you're talking about is the new Project for New American Century, American Enterprise funded, a continuation of that entire agenda. And you've mentioned the media. So does your film address the penetration of the neoconservatives into corporate media in the U.S., or can you comment on that yourself?
Yeah, it does a bit. I mean, I'd say it's both showing how the mainstream, the generic media pundits and stuff, they'll buy into a lot of this rhetoric. But I mostly just show how the actual neocons themselves will always be asked on television to appear as experts. And that's sort of what I show more in my movie, is how Bill Kristol and people like the newer generation of neocons, this whole younger generation, I call them the new neocons, guys like Eli Lake, Jamie Kirchick, Josh Rogan. These are all younger journalists now. They serve as almost like an echo chamber for these older neocons. And they write for publications like the Daily Beast, Bloomberg. Some of them even write for BuzzFeed. So it creates a whole new challenge, because before, people would see a neocon go on Fox News or a neocon go on CNN and be like, oh, that's a neocon trying to sell me a war on a news station that's obviously bought and paid for by corporations, blah, blah, blah. But now you see, you know, neocon propaganda come through this cleverly written, you know, snarky kind of hip sounding article on the Daily Beast. And it's like, oh, you know, it's like a whole new challenge, I think, that we face in the media in terms of fighting that. But to me, that's where I see most of the sort of the neocon influence in its most dangerous form is coming through those publications. But I tried to cover that as much as possible in the movie, but at a certain point, the movie mostly rests on their own words. So whatever they've said themselves, I've tried to basically allow them to fall on their own sword, so to speak.
We're speaking with journalist and filmmaker Robbie Martin. His latest film, A Very Heavy Agenda. We're talking on the around the 14th anniversary of the events of September 11th and where we've gone there in terms of foreign policy and war since. And we will be back to continue our conversation with Robbie Martin after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're speaking with journalist and filmmaker Robbie Martin. We're speaking about his new film, A Very Heavy Agenda. And Robbie, just before the break, you were saying how you were kind of trying to pull out these folks, let them fall on their own swords, so to speak, use their own words to just really listen to what they're saying, mm-hmm. right? And you had mentioned that there's sort of this new, hipper, neo-neocon, new, right? That's kind of reframing it and saying it in a different way, maybe for the millennial generation, right?
Absolutely.
To kind of continue this. And it's, of course, very clever form. A manifestation of this kind of propaganda that's less establishment, less kind of wonkish, Paul Wolfowitz-y, right? And like you said, hip, right? And gets different attention, different readership, different platforms, including social media. Mm-hmm. But going back to this issue of taking these people at their word, so to speak, and hearing the things that they say, you mentioned earlier in our conversation that Don and Fred Kagan, just after 9/11, were in an interview, and they were talking, you know, out loud about what they should do in terms of who are they going to go after vis-a-vis 9/11, Afghanistan, bin Laden. And Don Kagan says, quote, as long as we go after the actual perpetrators, our job is going to be next to impossible, end quote, and that Afghanistan is a distraction. And then they go on to say, Afghanistan was hurriedly brushed aside by both so they could shoehorn in their preferable target for a U.S. military response, and that's Palestine. And you write this on the blog, averyheavyagenda.blogspot.com. Could you talk a little bit more about that and that segueing of, never mind who might be involved in this, we have Palestine to deal with?
Yeah, well, it was a really surreal experience for me because I found that clip, and as far as I know, I'm the only one to put that clip online and transcribe it. It was on some obscure AM radio station in D.C. that they went on the day after 9/11. And I remember listening to it late at night. I think I was falling asleep. And I remember waking up the next morning and thinking to myself, oh, wow, I had a really weird dream last night that the Kagans were talking about wanting to invade Palestine and predicting the anthrax attacks only a day after 9/11. And I was like, wow, that was a really weird dream. And then I went to my computer and I realized that I wasn't a dream. And I actually found them talking like this. And I was so shocked by it that I had to look at Don Kagan specifically more closely because I just found it so odd, first of all, that he was saying we need to invade Palestine in retaliation for 9/11, and not saying that we need to, like, let the IDF clean out Arafat. He was saying he wanted American ground troops to land in Israel and fight terrorists in Palestine, which is just such a weird premise for multiple reasons. I mean, you know, that the IDF and would even want American soldiers on the ground there. It's just, it's strange. But what was stranger to me even more than that, I mean, that's an awful, crazy thing to suggest. But when I did American Anthrax, I found little hints, bits and pieces of people who seemed to have a lot of strange foreknowledge about the anthrax attacks before they actually happened. One of the main ones was Richard Perl. He was saying that the next attack is going to be biological. He said that before the first anthrax letters went out. But strangely, Don Kagan was saying that people are going to relax after 9/11 and think it was only a one shot. But what would have happened if the terrorists had on those planes, they had anthrax? And then he goes on to say that if they did that, if someone wanted to send anthrax, there's no way we could stop them from doing it. And this is on 9/12, one day after 9/11. Several days before the anthrax perpetrator, whoever it was, sent out the letters. And I found that just incredibly strange prescience, I guess you would call it, that he had. So I went back and looked at other statements he made. And, you know, other people have found strange statements by Paul Wolfowitz and other people that where they seemingly predict 9/11. You know, like Paul Wolfowitz said that it's surprising that we were surprised by Pearl Harbor and that
the new Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. And this was a couple months before 9/11. He was talking about the idea of surprise attacks and how we're always act like, oh, how did this happen? But we're always unprepared. And he hits on all these bullseyes about what actually happened on 9/11, you know, strangely. But Don Kagan did the same thing multiple times. He said that if Pearl Harbor happens again, it's not going to be a Pearl Harbor. It's going to be in New York or L.A. He said this in June of 2001.
The irony there is the invocation of an event that's historiographically troubled itself, given the government documents
right?
on FDR. But we'll set that aside momentarily, given the popular knowledge and interpretation of it is attached to sneak attack, which, again, I take historical issue with. But nevertheless, go ahead, continue.
So Don Kagan, it turns out that the phrase "a new Pearl Harbor," the idea of that phrase, it's really actually impossible when you read Rebuilding America's Defenses to figure out who wrote that phrase. You could go back to the principal author of the document, a guy named Thomas Donnelly, but when you really go back and look at Thomas Donnelly's previous work, it's not really that impressive or interesting. It's kind of pretty basic stuff. There's three people credited as the main people behind Rebuilding America's Defenses: Thomas Donnelly, Gary Schmidt, one of the co-founders of PNAC, and Don Kagan. Mm-hmm. So that intrigued me. I was like, oh, Don Kagan, he hit on all these bullseyes too before 9/11. That's really odd. So I went back and found this book of his called When America Sleeps that was written by him and Fred Kagan about a year before Rebuilding America's Defenses, that's essentially saying a lot of the same stuff. It talks about how we couldn't go to war without a galvanizing event like Pearl Harbor, using a lot of the same language. So I'm pretty convinced at this point that it was Don Kagan, or maybe Fred Kagan, who came up with that wording in the document Rebuilding America's Defenses.
And of course, if you look at the Chicago School and a lot of the people in the W. Bush administration, you know, whether it's Ken Adelman or Pearl or Wolfowitz, I mean, they certainly have the strain there.
Oh, absolutely.
Right,
yeah.
And the dissertation material on false flags and so forth that some of these people did at the University of Chicago. And then Philip Zelikow. We haven't mentioned him at all.
Yeah.
That's a whole show in and of itself. An historian that's in charge of the 9/11 Commission report, the chief editor, saying what's in the report, saying what's out of the report, essentially. And Zelikow, of course, had connections with Condoleezza Rice and other neoconservatives while allegedly objectively investigating the Bush administration.
Yeah, he's almost, in a strange way, he's almost like a younger version of Don Kagan, because he is mostly a historian, but they actually intersect at a certain point, Philip Zelikow and Don Kagan.
And Zelikow's a professor of history at the University of Virginia now.
Yeah, and Zelikow also predicted 9/11 in a very eerie way, very specific way. But he wrote a book on JFK that was sort of found out later to have been manipulated the historical record in a similar way to what Don Kagan and his sons have done, is they basically make JFK seem like a neoconservative in retrospect. They go back and look at his old, I guess, all these old audio recordings that are in these archives somewhere, and they actually transcribe them incorrectly, like blatantly false transcriptions that aren't even just misinterpretation of the audio. It's like they change the wording slightly to make it seem like JFK was trying to do more hawkish neoconservative things at the time. So I thought that was interesting, because I had looked a lot at Philip Zelikow before, and then when I found out that Don Kagan was also putting out a lot of this, you know, fake kind of JFK stuff in the 90s, it made me, you know, think, oh, well, maybe they, you know, I'm sure there was some cross influence there. I mean, Don Kagan is also one of the main people who's gone around and tried to rewrite the narrative of Hiroshima and Nagasaki as well, written a lot of modern articles and writings about how it saved lives.
Which, you know, reiterates Truman's line at the time, even though that's pretty much been debunked by Peter Kuznick and mm-hmm. many others. Jacques Powell's, we've done numerous shows on some of that in the myth of the bomb and this kind of business. Real doublespeak there, too, right? We had to kill more people to save more people yeah. kind of thing, destroy the village to save it talk. We're speaking with journalist Robbie Martin, filmmaker. Also musician, goes by the name Fluorescent Gray, has recently composed the music for his sister, Abby Martin's new show, The Empire Files, on Telesur and Real News Network. Robbie's, again, very, very busy, quite prolific in filmmaking and his journalism. American Anthrax was one film. His recent film is called A Very Heavy Agenda. You can see more at a blog. It's called averyheavyagenda.blogspot.com. Also at mediaroots.org. Robbie Martin, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I'd just sort of like to give you some time here for some conclusive remarks, and also perhaps to tell people more of how they can follow your work and see more of what you're doing.
I'm on Twitter. If you can follow me at Fluorescent Gray. And my blog, averyheavyagenda.blogspot.com, it's going to have a lot more updates put up on it soon as I launch the next two parts of the movie. There'll be DVDs for sale of A Very Heavy Agenda Part 1 fairly soon, so you can order them at that blog. And you'll see some of my contributions to Abby's new show, The Empire Files. I think episode 3 of her show is going to be talking to some degree about the Kagan Family Institute for Study of War and stuff like that. So doing a little bit of stuff with my sister on Empire Files besides the music, mm-hmm. and just trying to finish up part 2 and 3 of Very Heavy Agenda right now, and looking for places to screen those.
Hey, well, people can certainly contact you through the website or through mediaroots.org and the blog, or follow you on Twitter. Robbie Martin, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today surrounding the 14th anniversary of the events of 9/11.
Thank you so much.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
That does it for the show today. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're tuned to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. Also thanks to Alexandria McDowell, our Project Censored intern. The Project Censored show airs on over 25 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We welcome our new affiliate station, WOHM, in Charleston, South Carolina. We'll see you next time.
Criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous, so the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, in the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach all potential, fame at the table, then you probably own